Welcome to the Wealth Matters Podcast, where investors come together to better understand how to build passive cash flow and create generational wealth without all the confusing mumbo jumbo. Here's your host and co-author of Amazon number one bestseller, Alpesh Pamar.
Welcome to Wealth Matters Podcast. I am going to talk to Ben Fraser today. He's the CIO of Aspen Funds, and we have actually done one deal together, the retail shopping center. So I have known Bob Fraser as well. So Ben comes with a lot of experience, and he combines his analytical nature with a passion of delivering outstanding client service and strong returns through out-of-the-box investments. Ben also has experience working in the asset management industry, having served as a key player managing account from $3 billion asset under management to $7 billion asset under management. So welcome, Ben.
Hey, thanks for having me. Looking forward to our chat here.
Absolutely. So Ben, we start with this question with every guest. Tell us something interesting or funny about yourself.
Oh, man. Okay. Well, the first place my mind always goes is I am an official girl dad to the max. I have four daughters, no sons. And so I very, very busy brushing hair and actually participate in a ballet with my daughters, which is a little embarrassing to admit, but it's fun.
So I'm pretty close to you. I'm 4x2. I have two daughters and we are done, but I can relate. That's why I was laughing. So let's talk about investment, because we talk about alternative investments in this show. And of course, most of us invest in real estate. But what was your first investment and how did it work out for you?
Oh, man. Okay. Well, you're getting out all the scoop out of me today. But before I invested in real estate, I thought I would try my hand at drop shipping, an e-commerce business.
Oh, wow.
and so I went to like some of these online marketplaces where you can buy and trade websites and businesses and, thought I could figure it out, the whole drop shipping game. But, you know, long story short, it did not work out. And definitely lost some money, but learned a lot of good lessons along the way, and definitely got me very much more excited for real estate, which I was already kind of getting involved in at that point. But that was kind of the first investment where I actually sent cash. But ever since then, most of my portfolio has been exclusively in real estate, oil and gas since then. So definitely like the tried and true nature of real estate.
Now, I'm glad that you brought that up, because it's all about taking action. Even that time you took action, right? Not a lot of the people would think, oh, yeah, I should, my first investment, let me go buy, drop shipping business, or let me go buy even a real estate property. Most of the time they're like, oh, yeah, I'll go invest in this mutual fund or this stock and I'm good, right? That's where even I started. But I started thinking about, I also tried my hands at Amazon wholesaling.
Okay.
And yep. I fell flat. I lost money and I would never do it again. But I learned a lot of lessons too.
So, oh man. Yeah, we could have a whole segment on that if
y'all exactly.
Commiserations. Yeah.
So let's talk about market. Because when I listen to your podcasts and webinars, right? You guys talk a lot about trends and markets. So what are you seeing in the stock market right now?
Yeah, the stock market, to be honest, I don't follow it daily. I'm not really a market predictor from that standpoint, because what we do is pretty much exclusively in the private markets. But you have a finance background. We do track a lot of what's going on in the public markets, because yes, it does impact private markets. Our kind of thoughts right now and really, predictions are, it's interesting to see, year to date markets are actually up despite a lot of the turmoil going on. But I think right now we're in a very unique position, because, going back to underlying trends that kind of supersede whether public or private markets are inflation. We've been talking about this for the past 18 months, in that we believe inflation is going to be sticky. We believe it's going to be around for a while for a variety of reasons, which we can get into. And I think there's these competing you know, powers of, you know, supply, demand, you know, inflation, interest rates, right, and things that are causing a lot of ups and downs in the market. And so if you look back at other past cycles, you know, it's hard to time the market, quote unquote, but timing really does matter. And there are periods, actually decades, there's kind of called lost decades, where you can invest in a market and then a decade later, you're really at the same position that you were 10 years ago. Right. And so it's these kind of muddle through, these kind of sideways markets. I think there's a lot of things that are teeing up to kind of be a recipe for a pretty sideways market, because we are going to be kind of in this up and down, right? We have some positive factors in the economy that are helping bolster, you know, some of the sentiment. And then we have, you know, we just, crude oil, for example, is spiking up. And so now people are concerned, oh man, that impacts CPI, which impacts inflation, right, which impacts the Fed, which impacts interest rates. So there's all these kind of competing forces that we're struggling with, and it's going to take some time for a lot of this to work through the system. And I think because of that, when the markets don't have confidence, the markets just oscillate. And right, so I think we're going to see a lot of up and down, a lot of sideways movement, and, you know, with some potential for some bigger downside drops if, you know, some of these other bigger, you know, factors or black swan events could happen.
I agree. And I you're right, because the CPI right now is pretty skewed because of oil and shelter, right? Yeah. I see those are the big names, right? They are causing the inflation to spike. But let me ask you this, and you mentioned about inflation is going to be sticky. Why do you think so?
Yeah, well, I think the primary reasons that we've said for a while, one is housing, right? Because housing is a big component of CPI. We're seeing that to kind of slow down a little bit. So I think that will take a little bit of pressure off of CPI. We're already kind of seeing, it is a lagging metric that's being reported into CPI.
Right.
And so I do think over the past 12 months, we've seen a big slowdown of rent growth, and some markets even rent declines. So that's going to take some pressure off. But the other factors are really labor shortage and energy. So energy, we can talk about, because there's a whole other kind of thesis behind that. But we are, we actually think we're at the beginning of a severe supply crisis of oil and gas. These are fossil fuels. And we've not been investing like we have over the past decades back into the production. And it's an inelastic supply curve. It's not something that you can all of a sudden just flip a switch when we need more oil and just magically produce more. It's a multi-year, multi-investment process that we need to always be investing in to continue to, you know, have a stasis of production, let alone increase the production. And then the other piece of it is labor shortage. So we've actually seen, you know, since COVID, a massive exit of labor from the workforce. A lot of it was kind of people that tail end of their careers that decided to retire early, you know, maybe take severance and, you know, just kind of take an early retirement. And the other piece of it was dual income households that decided to go to a single income, right? Because, you know, some of the stimulus and other things that were in, you know, making it an easier decision to, hey, let's not do daycare and let's save the expense there. And we're actually going to make more money because wages are actually increasing because of that pressure. So we've seen a ton of pressure on wage growth, which is very inflationary, right? When you have less labor, you know, it's going to put higher pressures on wages, which is going to be inflationary. And there's not any simple solutions to solve a labor crisis because, you know, in the short term, you know, there's just not enough workers. I think, you know, there's a big article, we actually did a podcast on this talking about, is the job boom over? Because there's some people saying, oh, it's over now, the pressure's off. But if you look at the gap for the actual number of jobs that are being marketed to the number of employees looking for jobs, it's just this huge, huge gap that we haven't seen in such a long time. And that just keeps putting a lot of pressure on wages. So I think we've seen the peak of inflation. You know, we've seen this kind of come down. But the big factor here that's going to drive what happens now is the Fed's commitment to that 2% inflation rate, right? They've been saying we want 2%, 2%, 2%. And, you know, maybe some of that's posturing, but it doesn't appear to be. And if they really want that 2% number, it's going to be very difficult to get down to that 2%. Maybe we can get down to 4%, maybe even 3%. but it's going to be a while before they can get it back to 2% because of some of these fundamental dislocations in the market that are very inflationary in the short term. So I think over the next couple of years, we're going to see higher inflation, and the Fed has shown a pretty strong resolve to really try and meet that. And, you know, they haven't seen a huge level of unemployment as a result of, you know, the increases in interest rates, but we're also really early in the consequence, you know, domino impact of what's going to happen as, you know, these interest rates start to kind of materialize and metastasize in some of these markets and actually create a lot more challenges and turmoil. So, you know, it's anyone's guess. I'm not, you know, I don't have a crystal ball, but I think from a fundamental just standpoint of inflation, it's pretty clear it's going to be difficult to get down. So then it's really, what does the Fed do? How does it impact the rest of the capital markets and the different asset classes that we're all invested in, right? So, yeah, going back to the stock market, you know, those are the trends we're seeing. Those are, you know, the other kind of pieces of it that we're trying to navigate through.
And what kind of real estate trends are you seeing right now?
Yeah, well, I think it's such a unique time because we're, I think, early in this acceptance of rates are going to be higher for longer. If rates are higher for longer, you know, what does that mean? I think it's putting a lot of pressure, upward pressure on cap rates. I think values have to come down, especially in the asset classes that we're trading at super, super low cap rates, right? Because the negative leverage is that much more impactful. And so multifamily, I think, is probably at the biggest disadvantage from that standpoint. You know, office, I think, you know, people are talking about the demise of commercial real estate and, you know, commercial real estate's over and blah, 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 blah. I don't necessarily go that far, but I do think a lot of people group the office sector, you know, as commercial real estate, because it is, I think, the second largest sector within commercial real estate. That's a whole other animal, right? That's got its own challenges that I honestly have no idea how they're going to be solved. I just think these are going to trade at, you know, until they trade at such deep discounts to value to where either conversions make sense or repurposing, redeveloping them into something else, or just a new set of values for here's this kind of occupancy that's just normal now, right? I mean, I think there's got to be a huge reckoning within office, but within the other kind of asset classes, you know, multifamily, we're seeing a correction of values there. You know, but what we're trying to look at right now is look at where are kind of the hidden gems, right? Where are the kind of sweet spots that even despite these extra pressures, there's enough economic tailwinds, there's enough you know, underlying support for the thesis of this investment class that it makes sense to continue to invest in there. And I think, you know, some of those trends, one, you mentioned earlier, we have some retail strip centers that we own mutually. And those are continue to be a really shining spot in the economy right now. It's just a beautiful, you know, from a pure economic standpoint,
right?
It's just amazing, right? There's limited supply. The replacement cost is so high, no one's building any new ones.
Correct.
There continues to be very strong demand from a tenant standpoint. And because there's limited supply, vacancy rates have gone down to historic lows and rent growth continues to be really, really strong, right? It's like, if you could just take away the headline of it's retail because people just get freaked out by it for some reason, you would be like, I want to invest all my money into this because we're buying these at 8 to 9% cap rates day one. And we stabilize these a lot of times 13 to 14% cap rates. I mean, this is insane. You don't find this anywhere else in real estate.
I agree.
And so we really love that. You know, the downside of the challenge is they're hard to find. They're usually smaller. So it's, you know, to kind of build a portfolio takes time. But we think it's the thesis is going to win out. And ultimately, if there's demand for a product, which there's clearly demand for these, eventually prices have to trade to a certain, you know, spread to new construction. And right now no one's building because the construction is so high on these properties. And so that's a natural boon to values. The other asset class we really, really like is industrial. So industrial has actually likely been the least impacted from a value standpoint of all other real estate asset classes. And that's because we actually, you know, go back to the trends side of this, we think we're kind of in this a phase two of an industrial boom. you know, the first boom was caused by e-commerce and really the distribution, warehousing, you know, Amazon taking over, you know, a big portion of kind of the retail landscape. But, you know, it's not, you know, the growth is still there, but the growth has slowed down massively. It's somewhat plateauing, right? From as much as a percent of retail, it's not taking over as much as it used to. But the other kind of driver of the secondary boom has really been accelerated since COVID, which is the reshoring trend.
Yeah, making inventory.
So bringing manufacturing back and bringing inventory back, you know, to the U.S. or to, you know, the Mexico, Canada borders where we have great trade relationships. Yeah. And so we're very bullish on that. So it's a little bit different of a use case than just pure distribution warehousing, though we do think there is still some value in those, but it's really positioning and really the markets that are going to outperform over time. So we're actually very bullish on that. We're actually right now doing speculative development, which sounds crazy to do in a cycle like this, but because of the demand, again, we're at record low vacancies across the board. These are decisions that are being made by very large companies, a lot of times multinational companies, that are going to impact their businesses for the next decade, right? Because to reshift where their manufacturing, you know, core is or how their supply chain is put together, it kind of supersedes what the economic environment is. And maybe that, you know, delays some of the you know, timeline of what they're doing, but ultimately, they're not looking at just the short term. They're looking at these long-term trends of repositioning the entire manufacturing and supply chain that they have. And so these are decisions that they're making outside of you know, the economic short-term, you know, impact that we're seeing right now. And because of that, we're still seeing a lot of reshoring happening, a lot of jobs being brought back to the US, a lot of, you know, new manufacturing plants being opened. I mean, the trend is still alive and well.
Right. So, and I totally agree about retail and industrial as well. I definitely, what do you think about malls? I think they are going, you know, the same way. Most probably they're going away like some office buildings, not all of them. At least in my area, and I live in San Francisco Bay Area, a lot of office buildings are getting demolished and they're getting converted into single family housing. So, but I'm not sure what's going on with mall. And when we mentioned retail, a lot of people think or put them in the same bucket, like the strip center is same as a shopping mall. And that's not the case, as we know.
100%. I think that is one of the challenges of retail as a headline, because there's actually about four different types of retail real estate, right? And shopping malls being one of them. And shopping malls probably being the most negatively impacted, and probably the true dinosaur of the asset class, right? I do think there's an evolution of retail that is moving on from the traditional shopping malls. You know, I do think it, you know, we're here in Kansas City. We actually have a shopping mall that they kind of redeveloped and kind of went from inward facing to outward facing and brought a lot of big national retailers in the heart of the city. And it's actually still very, very vibrant, very high occupancy. People love going there still. So it's kind of like we went more for the experience and, you know, shifted to kind of the more standard, you know, outward facing type of retail approach to make it more accessible. But that's the only one I've seen that's actually worked and kind of evolved itself, you know, through the changing patterns. But what we're talking about are these neighborhood strip centers. These are smaller properties, usually about 50,000 square feet, and they're located in the neighborhoods that people live in, right? And so part of the reason why they're doing so well is, as people have shifted to more working from home, more of a hybrid work schedule, they're frequenting these a lot more often.
Right.
And it's on the way home from work. It's, you know, right by where they live. And they're generally, you know, the tenant base is usually irreplaceable by e-commerce. Yeah. It's generally, you know, service based. So it's the dog groomers, it's the liquor
hair
stores,
care, nail salon,
hair care.
You got to go there. You can't order it online.
These are things you can't do online. Exactly. And so they're businesses that have to exist physically. And what's kind of interesting is we're actually seeing the pendulum swing a little bit in retail, where, you know, so much of these, you know, big box online presences like Amazon and, you know, other big retailers that are mostly online, they went so far to one side, but they're actually kind of swinging back and actually on a net basis, opening new physical stores. Yeah. Right. It was so interesting when Amazon acquired Whole Foods.
Right. Yeah.
Right. Cause it was really a strategic acquisition, not just they like grocery, but they actually liked having the hybrid approach where they could deliver other services through a physical store. And so they're actually seeing this kind of pendulum swing back more to a hybrid approach where a lot of these retailers like, they want to be digital first, but they also want to have the physical presence to meet the other needs of the clients. And, you know, so it's seeming to be a winning strategy from a retailer standpoint.
Oh, that's great. Now let's talk about investment side, right? So as passive investors or even just individuals investing on their own, what is the importance of asset allocation and how should individuals tailor their portfolios to their risk tolerance and financial goals?
Yeah, great question. And, you know, obviously got to give the caveat, I'm not a financial advisor. So, you know, anything I say is just my own opinion. But, you know, I think there's some good principles that people can use when deciding, you know, what's the right investment for me. And we talk a lot about this on our podcast where, you know, a lot of people get excited about the opportunities that alternative investments can provide, right? You get some great tax benefits, you get some cash flow, you get some upside, and, you know, get less volatility than the stock market. Right. These are all very attractive things. But what happens is as people start investing in these, they just kind of do what I call the, you know, kind of sock drawer approach. And whatever kind of comes in their email inbox, you know, they just kind of invest, you know, I'll invest with Uncle Jerry, I'll invest with this guy that I met at the golf course, I'll invest here, there, there. And then all of a sudden, they've just kind of, you know, a year or 2 years later, they look back and all the things that they've invested in, there's no strategy behind it. There is no, you know, real diligence behind the one things they're making. There was no real portfolio allocation behind it, right? And a lot of times people have very high concentrations in, say, multifamily, because that's what a lot of what was being syndicated or people were raising for, and especially Sunbelt, you know, multifamily. And so a lot of times you could just unknowingly have a pretty high concentration in an asset class in a certain, you know, geography that you didn't even realize. And so what I always say is first define your goals. Is your goal, you know, income to replace income? Is your goal long-term growth? Is your goal, you know, tax efficiency? And it's probably a combination of all three of these, right? But what is that? Define that first and then really go in it with a very intentional approach, right? When, what I always say is people spend so much time building their careers, building their businesses, so much intentionality going to school for how many years to become, you know, a doctor or a professional in another area. And you invest so much time, effort, energy, focus on building your net worth, building your income, but almost no thought to how do you grow it?
Right.
How do you protect it? How do you multiply it? Right. And I think you should be spending as much or more time doing that. And so it's really I think it should be a long-term approach, slow down, right? You don't need to invest all your money in 1 year, right? If you had a big liquidity event, you gotta manage, you gotta figure out some good plans, talk with some experts on that. But, you know, that's the, you know, the exception to the rule. And I think people can take a more intentional approach where they're actually diversifying across asset classes, diversify across operators, diversify across geographies. And what we always kind of, the layer that we add on to everything is invest where the economic tailwinds are, right? Invest where there's actual support behind you economically and from a supply demand standpoint, a pure fundamental standpoint, because ultimately every deal, I can guarantee you, every deal you invest in will not go according to plan. Some will go better than planned and some will go worse than planned. That's just the nature of life and of investing.
Yeah, that is why you got to diversify, right?
That's why you diversify. And it's also why I want to invest where I know there's extra tailwind, because right now I'm investing in oil and gas, right? I think it's a great place to be from a macro standpoint, but there's some things I can't anticipate. But if oil prices stay high for a while, that's going to be a support to any deal that I do, whether it's a marginal deal or a really, really good deal, right? Having that extra tailwind is going to help create margin. It's going to help create just more tailwinds behind things you're doing, because you can be operating the best deal, the best way, but if the market's going down, if the stars aren't aligned and the interest rates are coming, you have, you know, an interest rate cap expiring and you can't refinance, doesn't matter how good of an operator you are in a down cycle, you might get creamed, right? So I'd rather be, you know, have the tailwinds behind. So that's always the layer that we add on, I think, is unique to some people, and just thinking about what are the big trends that are supporting where I'm investing. So I just have that much more margin. I have that much more, tailwinds behind what I'm doing to just help out when things don't go according to plan.
Well, that's a great point. And let's talk about real estate market again, right? How has the real estate market evolved now? And what opportunities exist for wealth creation in today's market, right? After all these changes, higher interest rates.
Yeah. Yeah, well, the real estate market it's cyclical, just like every other market. And so we're in, a down cycle. We have higher interest rates. It's making borrowing costs, way more expensive. We're also seeing just general operating costs. Insurance is going up. Labor's yes. harder to find. Property taxes are going up, right? All these things are putting pressure on margins. But in a lot of real estate and even multifamily in several markets, I'm still very bullish on, because I think there's a housing shortage. And I think there's a true need and true demand long term for a lot of the different types of housing product that are out there. But just like anything, it goes in cycles, and you have to be smart about when you're investing, at what point of the cycle, and how you're investing. And so from an investment standpoint, I think going lower in the capital stack is smart. So, reducing your risk, going where you've got really good debt in place. I think debt is the number one thing I think every investor should be looking at, understanding, how that impacts the deal. What are the downsides, and what type of lender are they working with? Right. These are very, very important questions, especially right now. And then just overall from a real estate standpoint, from my standpoint, I love that the access to these types of investments has exponentially increased over the past decade because of the different regulations that now opened up these types of opportunities to the average, retail investor. Like, we can go and invest in a lot of these cool opportunities that we couldn't invest in before the Jobs Act. But the same side of that token is there's a lot of people that are brand new syndicators. I actually call it a syndication bubble that's happened the past three or four years. It seems like everybody became a professional syndicator because they all took $1,000 course on online and now know how to raise money from, friends and family and grandma, but I just think, the basic rules apply. You got to invest with the right people in the right markets and the right assets, and make sure the team around it has been around for a while. Make sure they're looking at all the right things. They're mitigating the most important risks, and they know how to manage through down cycles, because it's way more challenging to invest, to do deals right now. But it's also, I believe, a really good time to be keeping your eyes open and to be looking for these, really, really great opportunities that are going to come from potentially some of this distress that's going to be hitting the market and already starting to. So I actually think some of the best deals to invest in are about to be hitting the market over the next 6 to 12 months. And we're trying to position for those. But it takes confidence, takes, an investor that understands what to look for and to partner with the right people to be ready for those.
Oh, this is awesome. And I remember, because when we started talking, I think 3-4 years ago, you guys were focused on the notes, right? The debt funds. How is that going? And is there still some juice left in that industry? Or is it going to get better?
So we started in debt, 11 years ago, continue to operate that. We really have two sides of it. One is distressed notes. These are non-performing mortgages, what we're generally buying. The other side of it is kind of scratch and dent performing loans. The non-performing side of it, it's really slowed down because it's somewhat counter-cyclical, right? It kind of happens in these periods of distress, and then it kind of filters through the financial system, and it eventually runs through to private equity funds like ours. And so we had a pretty big push, obviously, coming out of the great financial crisis. There's a lot of distressed debt in single family. And we're still, you know, being able to transact in those, but there's a lot less than there was. The other side of it is there's a lot of higher yielding mortgages that are still, I believe, trading well below intrinsic value. And so, you know, our pace of scale is slowed there, but we're still, you know, acquiring active portfolios right now. And they've been great. Where we actually think there is going to be some opportunity, and we're kind of positioning a little bit for that, is a lot more distress in the commercial side of it.
Right.
And what we're seeing is a lot of, you know, these operators that actually have really good assets. The asset is great, but they've got a ticking clock with the lender they have.
Yes.
their investors are all freaked out. No one wants to do a capital call. And so we actually think there's going to be some great opportunities to come in as a secured lender. And, you know, we're going to charge you a pretty high interest rate. And we may take the property back, but we're going to be the best option for you, other than just giving the keys back to your other lender. So we think there's going to be some opportunities there, and we're actively kind of positioning for that. But we think it's the distress is going to happen differently this cycle than it was last cycle. So something that we're definitely paying attention to.
This is great. So last question before we, you know, move on to the next round. Do you think a recession is coming, or did it already pass?
Yeah. You know, I again wish I had a crystal ball.
Yes.
I think, you know, we were earlier on, you know, more heavily leaning towards recession. We've since kind of shifted more, probably closer to a soft landing is probable. What I think is really interesting with what the Fed has done is I think they've kind of manufactured a softening of the decline curve, right? Instead of all of a sudden the economy just falls off a cliff and we just have this huge decline. Yeah. They've kind of been manufacturing through the interest rate increases this smoothness of a decline, right? And does it actually translate it to a recession? You know, part of that depends on does some kind of black swan event happen, right? There's a lot of things that could happen. I mean, China, I think, is a really big wild card here. I think, you know, if you've been paying attention, but China is actually having potentially massive deflation.
Yes.
Some of the reports come out say there could be unemployment numbers as high as 20 or 25% in the younger generations. And they're not sharing the data. They're manufacturing a lot of their data, right? So it's really hard to know. But yes. I think that could be a huge domino that triggers things off. What, you know, a lot of this debt that's maturing in the commercial real estate space, I think, is, you know, headed for some challenges. What are the lenders going to do? And how long do the interest rates remain, you know, steady at where they're at right now? Do you believe the futures curve of where interest rates kind of start to see some interest rate reductions? So I think it's hard to make a clear prediction. I think probability wise, I think definitely still more in the soft landing camp, though I think it's an uncomfortable landing, right? It's, you know, you barely make it out alive, but I think, hey, it's not this great financial crisis level of recession. Because we still have very strong employment, economy, right? We still have very strong
jobs,
you know, wage growth and strong GDP, and consumers are still spending. You know, sentiment's low, but you know, we're still seeing business and manufacturing, you know, happening. So there's still these kind of two big forces that are happening right now. We just again talked about this on our podcast, where there's over recently just been $200 billion raised for distressed commercial real estate.
Wow.
Just sitting on the sideline, right? There's a massive amount of demand and capital ready to be deployed into some of the stress. So we have some distress coming. Now, everyone knows that.
Yes.
But at the same time, we have this really unique level of demand waiting for it. So I think that's also going to soften it, right? And you know, for example, we just put an offer in on a very large Class A distressed property here locally. And we're saying, hey, we can, you know, get at a great in-place cap rate and kind of just hold right out this asset. It's a great location. It's one you'd love to hold for a long time and then recapitalize down the road and rates come down. Well, we thought we'd kind of be in at a decent range of the offers, probably on the low end. We were way below the offers they're saying they're getting. and they're paying still sub 5 cap rates.
Yeah.
For this Class A deal. So the market just hasn't, you know, the bid ask spread is just all over the place. And whether it's, you know, Class A, B, or C, I think partly matters, but it's, there's still a lot of capital, hungry capital looking for places to make returns. And so I think that's going to, that spread is going to, you know, shrink over time. But I think a recession is, you know, soft landing is very, very possible unless some kind of black swan event happens, which is also possible.
That's awesome. Thank you so much for sharing all those golden nuggets. Are you ready for fire round?
Okay, give it to me.
Would you be changing business or investment strategy because of this current environment?
Yeah, well, I think I've already shared that. You know, our whole approach is agile in the sense that we look first at the current environment to dictate our thesis. So absolutely.
Favorite nonfiction book? It could be self-improvement, investment, real estate.
Yeah, probably the one that comes to mind is just because I'm reading it right now, but it's by Dan Sullivan, a strategic coach.
He wrote
How Gap in the Gain. He wrote a new one called 10X is Easier Than 2X. 10X. And it's blowing my circuits right now. It's a really great book if you're an entrepreneur, or even just someone that's trying to just continue to level up in your life. How do you kind of make these big leaps? It's really, really cool.
Oh, his books are amazing. I loved Who Not How, man.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Any tool or website you recommend, or you use it every day?
Oh, man, I don't know. I love Audible. I mean, going back to the book thing, that's how I listen to a lot of the books. So I listen at, you know, very fast speed. Oh, speaking of speed, I do love this thing called Video Speed Controller. It's a plugin in Google Chrome.
Okay.
And any embedded video on any website, you can speed up to however fast you want. Oh, that's nice. So kind of like podcasts, you can listen to them faster. Yes. Or audiobooks. You can listen to any video way faster. And so
I love that because it just out.
Absorbs things faster. So Video Speed Controller, it's really great. Speed
control. Thank you. Any advice for investors?
Yeah, I think be cautiously optimistic. I think you want to have some cash reserves, but be ready for opportunities. I think they're going to be presenting themselves in the short term. And I think diversification is a proven principle that will help you ride out certain storms. So you know, have cash ready, look for opportunities because there's going to be them, and then diversify.
How do you give back?
Yeah, well, I try and give my time when I can. Like I said, I have 4 girls, so my time is pretty limited, but you know, I'm involved in several masterminds and a coach in one of them, helping capital raisers. And, you know, also helping, you know, younger people kind of getting started in real estate. And then just in Kansas City here, trying to help locally with some of the kind of local, you know, things that are going on with our city. But yeah, those are things I love to do. And hopefully as I have more time, I can do more of that.
How can my listeners reach out to you?
Yeah, well, if you like podcasts, we got our podcast called Invest Like a Billionaire. And then our private equity firm is Aspen Funds.
Okay. Thank you so much, Ben, for your time today.
Yeah, thanks, Alpesh. It was really fun.
Thanks for listening to the Wealth Matters podcast. If you enjoyed it, please leave us a 5-star rating on iTunes so others can enjoy the show too. Have a great week and happy investing.